This is Americana.
Come along, boys, and listen to my tale. I'll tell you all my troubles on the old Chisholm Trail. Tie-yi-yippee-yippee-yippee-yay, tie-yi-yippee-yippee-yay.
The words and music you have just heard are from an American folk song called The Old Chisholm Trail. This program is Americana, the second in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you The American Frontiersman.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. It's no news to historians that the American frontier is dead. Some of them, like Frederick Jackson Turner and his classic studies, or like Ray Billington in his more recent book, Western Expansion, will tell you that the frontier was the key fact in American history. They say that its passing, about the time that Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona joined the roster of states, has called for changes in our national outlook, which we are slow and reluctant to make. Indeed, I sometimes suspect that our generalized gloom at the passing of the frontier is matched somehow with the emotional tune of so many of the old range ballads, which is perhaps why they survive into this industrialized day.
As I walked out on the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day, I spied a poor cowboy wrapped up in white linen, wrapped up in white linen as cold as the clay. I see by your outfit that you are a cowboy, these words he did say as I boldly stepped by. Come sit down beside me and hear my sad story. I'm shot in the breast and I know I must die. Oh, beat the drum slowly and play the pipe slowly. Play the dead march as you carry me along. Take me to the green valley and lay the sod o'er me. For I'm a young cowboy and I know I've done wrong. It was once in the saddle I used to go laughing. Once in the saddle I used to go gay. First to the drinking and then to card playing. Got shot in the breast and I'm dying today. Get six jolly cowboys to carry my coffin. Six jolly maidens to carry my pall. Throw bunches of roses all over my coffin. Roses to deaden the clods as they fall. Oh, beat the drum slowly and play the pipe slowly. Play the dead march as you carry me along. Take me to the green valley and lay the sod o'er me. For I'm a young cowboy and I know I've done wrong.
Well, as Samuel Weller used to remark, it's an amiable weakness, this fondness for an archaic or maybe timeless past, and perhaps we shouldn't analyze it to death. Still, it's an odd phenomenon, and I have a theory. Who ever heard of a college professor without one? I have a theory that the phenomenon makes very good sense. Now, my theory is this. I think that in our modern imitations of a time and place that are forever gone, we're fumbling neither for time nor for place, but for a kind of man, a sort of individual that we understand only vaguely through the stereotypes of mass fictions, and yet a kind of individual that we feel urgently that we should somehow resemble. I've called this man the American frontiersman. What was he like? Is it possible to know? You will not mind, I hope, if we go about answering this question by a sort of cautious indirection. I want to talk, first of all, not about a man, but about a creation of man. The great cattle trail, which led in the 60s and 70s from Texas to Railroad's End in Kansas. The Chisholm Trail.
Oh, come along, boys, and listen to my tale. I tell you all my troubles on the old Chisholm Trail. Tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. On a $10 horse and a $40 saddle, I'm a-going to punch in Texas cattle. Tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay.
The trail followed, as Jesse Chisholm once said, the grass and the water. You started out with a herd somewhere in Texas. You crossed the Red River and headed north. And after that, your landmarks were the hoof marks of the herds before you and the water crossings. You picked up Mud Creek and followed that stream to its head. Then northwest to Wild Horse Creek. Then there was the Canadian River and the Cimarron, the wild and unruly, as the Spanish say. And the Black Bear and Bluff Creeks and the Salt Fork of the Arkansas, which you crossed near Sewell's Ranch. You came into Kansas near Caldwell and near the Chickaskia crossing past the place where they hang three horse thieves from the same limb. Up near the Nenasca crossing is the place where the Mexican killed Jack Redis. And further on is the place where Redis's friends killed the Mexican. Then you hit Wichita, which boasted the most famous watering hole of the trail. The First and Last Chance Saloon. 20-odd miles northeast lies Newton. And then you go over the divide between the Smoky Hill and the rivers to the prairies south of Abilene.
It's cloudy in the west and a-looking like rain. My darn old slicker's in the wagon again. Tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. We hit Caldwell and we hit her on a fly. We bedded down the cattle on a hill close by. Tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay.
At river crossings, the trail varied from 50 to 100 yards in width. Some places it spread out to 1 or 2 miles. You could make from 8 to 12 miles a day on the trail. From Texas to Newton or Ellsworth, it was 60, sometimes 90 long days. Along this trail for 20 years, there passed the wealth of an empire. In 1870, 300,000 head of Texas cattle were driven into Abilene. In 1871, nearly 1 million head went north. And then come a bad winter, and the Spanish fever followed the cold winds so that the cattle trade languished. But in 1873, Ellsworth on the Kansas Pacific Line and Newton on the Santa Fe became the trail's end for enormous herds. Like Abilene before him and Dodge City later, Newton and Ellsworth competed for the title, the wickedest town in the West. Newton was almost accidentally reformed one night when a consumptive boy entered the town's fanciest saloon, locked the door behind him, drew a gun, and single-handed disposed of most of the local bad men who had murdered his friend. Then came the luridest town of them all, Dodge City. The Santa Fe built its rails into Dodge, and the cattle trail shifted west. For 12 years thereafter, Dodge City was the somewhat gaudy queen of all western towns. The great year was 1884, when 825,000 head of cattle passed over the trail in a single 90-day period.
I went to the boss to draw my roll. He had it figured out, $9 in the hole. Come a tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. Sell my outfit as soon as I can. I won't punch cattle for no darn man. Come a tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. With my knees in the saddle and my seat in the sky, I'll quit punching cows in the sweet by and by. Come a tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay, tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay.
And that's something of the story of the trail. A great story, but I don't tell it entirely for its own sake. There's good reason why the trail should have become so meaningful to frontiersmen of the 70s, and why it remains a kind of permanent symbol of the cattle frontier. There are certain aspects of the trail's character which lie at the core of the frontiersman's character as well. One of these aspects, I think, is mobility. Not only was the trail a travel route, it was itself mobile. Like the men of the frontier, the trail moved west with the railroad from Abilene to Ellsworth, Newton, and Wichita, and then on to Dodge City. The other characteristic of the trail interests me still more, for you know the Chisholm Trail was gold-paved. It had that especially American characteristic of rags to riches, or conversely, of riches to rags. Dodge and Newton and Abilene were in their time boom towns, where the gold pieces were counted by the bucket, and nobody ever heard of a coin smaller than a silver dollar. The boomtown psychology is rooted deeply in the American character. Most of us, even in the most commonplace surroundings, still believe in the possibility of achieving fabulous wealth and fame overnight. That's why we glorify Hollywood stars and read eagerly about the man who won $300,000 in a prize contest and play slot machines in the races. They represent to us the lucky chance, the magical transformation, just as the trail and California gold and Colorado silver and Oklahoma oil and Florida land represented the lucky chance to Americans of an earlier generation.
Oh, don't you remember sweet Betsy from Pike, who crossed the wide prairies with her lover Ike, with two yoke of oxen, an old yellow dog, a tall Shanghai rooster, and one spotted hog. They soon reached the desert where Betsy gave out, and down in the sand she lay rolling about, while Ike in great terror looked on in surprise. Said Betsy, get up, you'll get sand in your eyes. The Shanghai ran off and the cattle all died. The last piece of bacon that morning was fried. Poor Ike got discouraged and Betsy got mad. The dog wagged his tail and looked wonderfully sad. Long Ike and sweet Betsy attended a dance, where Ike wore a pair of his Pike County pants. Sweet Betsy was decked up in ribbons and rings. Said Ike, you're an angel, but where are your wings? Sing toorally, oorally, oorally, eh.
A good deal of the generalizing we've done here would fit the life and character of Jesse Chisholm, whose name was given to the Chisholm Trail. There is, in addition, another fact about Chisholm which is important to the frontier character, his Indian blood and Indian outlook. Jesse Chisholm was born in Tennessee in 1806, the son of a Scotch trader and a Cherokee woman of distinguished family. He was a rather complex individual. Uneducated in the formal sense, he learned to speak 14 Indian languages as well as English. A scout and frontiersman, he made a small fortune as a trader, which he disposed of open-handedly. Some say that he adopted 9 children, orphaned or lost, on the western prairies and helped dozens of others. Chisholm made his trailblazing trip into Indian territory in 1865. On the way back north, they say that heavy rains caused his wagon wheels to cut deep tracks into the sod, and thus, almost by accident, the Chisholm Trail came into being. Jesse Chisholm died on March 4th, 1868, in a camp on the North Canadian River. 40 years later, J.R. Meade, his old trading partner, published a statement which he said Chisholm had made about 2 weeks before his death. It was, in effect, his last testament.
I don't know anything about the Bible. I don't take any stock in preachers. But the Great Spirit has implanted in every man's breast a knowledge of right and wrong. I don't know anything about the Bible. I don't take any stock in preachers. But the Great Spirit has implanted in every man's breast a knowledge of right and wrong. I've never wronged any man. I've done good to my brethren all my life. No man ever went from my camp hungry or naked. I've been a peacemaker among my brethren, and I leave all the future to the Great Spirit above who sent me here.
Along the trail passed many colorful citizens, settlers and gamblers, working cowhands and cattle kings, Indians and white men. Of them all, none was more colorful or in his way more magnificent than David Lewis Payne.
David L. Payne, born December 30th, 1836, died November 28th, 1884, a man of many distinctions. He had a distinguished career as a soldier, scout, and Indian fighter. He was a bad storekeeper, an inattentive postmaster, a successful politician, and, toward the end of his life, a kind of crusader. Perhaps the most interesting thing about Payne is that he was almost a perfect prototype of the present-day fictitious Westerner of films and stories. He was a man of impressive appearance, tall, handsome fellow, dark of hair and complexion, magnetic and charming in his manner. He was possessed of great strength and physical endurance. He was a man of simple and conventional virtue. He loved children. He impoverished himself to feed his neighbors in the hungry winter of 1870-71. Was generous to a defeated foe. In the Kansas legislature of 1872, he proposed and fought for a bill to enfranchise former Confederate soldiers. He was a cousin to Davy Crockett, a relative of Daniel Boone, friend of Kit Carson and Buffalo Bill Cody. He was a frontiersman by trade. Nothing seemed worth doing to him except it was hard and dangerous. But he was never able to settle down and enjoy the fruit of his toil.
Payne, as it happens, has a remarkable position in American frontier history. Against the express wishes of the federal government and over the opposition of the American army, Payne invaded Oklahoma, then Indian territory, on half a dozen occasions, an army of boomers at his back. It was principally his persistence which led to the opening of Indian territory to settlement in 1889. Some years ago, Carl Rister wrote a biography of Payne published by the University of Oklahoma Press, which he called Land Hunger. It's a good biography of a remarkable man, but I've never agreed with the title. Whatever David Payne hungered for, I hardly believe it was land. Let me give you one or two glimpses of the man, then you can judge for yourself. Payne was a volunteer soldier during the Civil War and the Indian skirmishes thereafter. Rifleman, company commander, and scout. He appears to have received at least four honorable discharges following his various enlistments. In the late 60s, following an Indian uprising in western Kansas, Payne raised a company and was commissioned by the governor as captain of Company D, 18th Kansas Cavalry. But it was cholera rather than Comanches that first hit Company D.
That awful disease, cholera, raged during that time, and 27% of the regiment was swept away. Payne himself barely recovered from a severe attack. In this terrible ordeal, his thought and cure were for the men of his company. He was at once a commander and a nurse. He went everywhere among the sick and dying, took the severest cases to his own tent, soothed with his own hands their dying hours, and paid from his private funds for the care of his men suffering from the contagion. On one occasion, after making a detail to care for the sick, he said, "I must have a few hours' rest. Here's $10 each. These men cannot recover. Take good care of them. Pay strict attention to their wants and note all they say. If they have any word for friends at home, be sure and get the name and place and remember their last request." It is told of him that when ordered from the fort on active service, two men of his company were left hopelessly ill in tents at the post. Payne visited them and, finding one suffering from lack of clothing, took clothes from his own back and, placing them on the dying soldier, remarked, "Cheer up, my boy. Don't be discouraged. I hope to see you real soon, and there'll be oceans of fun ahead on the prairie."
That last remark is a typical one. With the Black Death around him, the prospect of an Indian war ahead, talking to a dying man, Payne could say with complete honesty, "There'll be oceans of fun ahead on the prairie." It was not land hunger that motivated Payne and the others like him. It was the physical need, like a craving for drugs, for movement, change, danger. And since these motives could not be publicly admitted, Payne, like other frontiersmen, sometimes put on the mask of the empire builder.
Headquarters of the Southwest, Wichita, Kansas, January 1st, 1880. It is not generally known that there are some 14 million acres of land in Indian territory belonging to the United States. This immense domain is public land, the property of the United States, and is open to settlement. To effect the settlement upon these lands is the object of this association, and it purposes to organize a colony from 5,000 to 10,000 strong and move upon these lands in one body on or about the 15th of March, 1880. There is no finer body of country in the United States. It is well watered, well timbered, abounds in coal and minerals, and the Wichita Mountains are said to contain gold and silver. For all agricultural purposes, stock, grain, cotton, tobacco, and fruit raising, it cannot be excelled by any other section of the country between the Atlantic and the Pacific. The climate is nearly like that of California, neither too cold in winter nor too hot in summer. It is the only part of the public domain now open and within reach of the people this side of the Rocky Mountains that is worth occupying. The land problem is solved. The buffalo is gone, and the Indian must be civilized. Signed, David L. Payne.
And with these words, Payne took his colonists across the line into Indian territory. With commendable promptness, an army detachment located the new colony, arrested the settlers, and escorted them back across the Kansas line. For more than 4 years, until shortly before his death in 1884, Payne repeated the adventure. To a person reading the story 70 years later, there are elements of comedy in the great Boomer pilgrimage. But Payne himself was serious enough, and so were his followers. Witness, for example, the Boomer song of this period called Give Us a Home.
We sing of a song of a mighty wrong, which threatens the life of a nation. We're robbed by the rich, oppressed by the strong, who prostitute every high station. The country's life in the fearful strife is not thought of, but wholly neglected by those once in power who employ every hour for themselves from the time they're elected. The money and lands are cut, clutched by foul hands, thus kept from the poor and the needy, while liberty stands in fetters and bands, being outraged by officers greedy. The senators come at will, they may roam o'er 100 square miles of plantation, while a homeless may come, be denied a small home of the free public lands of the nation.
Payne himself seems to have been honestly convinced of the righteousness of his cause. He had, as a matter of fact, a remarkable gift of eloquence to which he was somewhat susceptible. There is, for example, his last visit to his birthplace in Indiana.
He asked, it is said, that all his people gather for a farewell. They stood in front of a little log cabin in which Payne was born. Payne, in his rough pioneer dress and wide-brimmed hat, stood on a stump of a one-time giant hickory that had stood in the dooryard. He pictured to his people the glories of Oklahoma, which he termed paradise of the world. He told of the wonderful homes that would one day be established there, and his eloquence stirred his listeners as he told of the alluring possibilities of the new territory. He expressed his desire that as many of his people as possible make preparations to establish homes in Oklahoma when the opening should occur. It is related that at the close of the meeting, it was pledged by four of the older men that they would allow their hair to grow in true Indian fashion until they should meet again. Payne died before the next meeting, but his desires were carried out.
Payne was, as we have noticed, a kind of apotheosis of the American frontiersman. Generous, kindly, violent, restless. The sort of man who builds civilizations in the wilderness. Not because he likes civilization, but because he needs an excuse for his dreams, his violence, his restlessness. One of the best summaries of Payne's life was written by Victor Murdoch, a Kansan who knew both Payne and his period. Perhaps it may stand as a kind of final word, not only on Payne, but on the American frontiersman as a type.
The Oklahoma opening of April 22nd, 1889, was especially exciting to me. I had known in my boyhood the man who had been preeminent in his agitation for that opening, David L. Payne. He had loomed in the ensemble of my early picture of Wichita, a gloomy figure of 6'4", topped by a floppy hat. It made no difference to me at the time that the story might be true that David Payne, had he lived, could not have exercised his homestead rights in Oklahoma, having already exhausted them in Kansas. The intensity of my interest in him and the adventure lost nothing thereby. What mattered with me was that he had ordained Oklahoma should be opened, and here Oklahoma was opening. Of the thousands of figures I scanned in the turbulent crowd I came upon in the new territory on its natal day, I looked in vain for an individual physically comparable to Payne. I'm fairly certain that there were none such. Besides, all those I saw were concerned mostly with the beginnings of their own careers. Payne, had he been there, would have counted the occasion the end of his, I'm sure. Things I've heard and read about Payne, particularly about his youth, further persuade me to this view. He indubitably belonged to the last in a series of American pioneers who, when the pioneering job, which was a passion with them, had been concluded, called it a day and were no longer interested. Had Payne lived to participate in the opening of Oklahoma, the experience would have palled on him within a week, and he probably would have dismissed the accomplished fact of settlement with cold disdain.
Have been listening to Americana, the second in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Howard Keegan. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Grisky. Tonight's program was based chiefly upon a collection of historical documents lent to Mr. Maloney by Mr. James Nicholson of Newton, Kansas. Books mentioned on the program were Ray Billington's Westward Expansion, published by the Macmillan Company, Herbert Marshall McLuhan's The Mechanical Bride, published by the Vanguard Press, and Carl Koch Rister's Land Hunger, published by the University of Oklahoma Press. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.